Hello, and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations Live, where we give you an insight into some of the inspiring programming events held at The Conduit. The Conduit is a collaborative community dedicated to building a just, prosperous, and sustainable future. In this episode, Conduit co-founder Paul Van Zyl is joined by Jean Olwang, founding CEO of Virgin Unite. Jean has had a remarkable career, working with some of the world's greatest changemakers. She discusses with Paul how she was able to draw on her unique experience to write her new book, Partnering, which is centered on the idea that great partnerships are vital to meaningful lives and successful organizations. This really is a wonderful conversation between peers, a dynamic interaction between two extraordinary people sharing pivotal moments in their lives. Here's Paul and Jean.
And one story I just want to share, which Paul is way more close to than I am, when we think of ending apartheid, we think immediately of Mandela, who was an extraordinary leader. But I think my whole lens changed when I was in South Africa just a few months after he had passed, and we were crammed into this tiny white tent at the Nelson Mandela Foundation, and it was pouring rain outside. Yet inside the tent with these 200 people, there was this unbelievable electric current of joy. And one after the other, these anti-apartheid heroes that Paul knows well, got up on stage, on this kind of rickety stage, and praised this great human being. But I think what was most interesting for me wasn't what they were saying on the stage, which was absolutely beautiful, but when they came off the stage, the incredible love that they had for each other still. And so I turned to one of the family members on my right, and I asked her, I said, how on earth do they still have this incredible depth of love after weathering the years of apartheid? And she said two things. She said, the first thing is that they had a purpose that they were going to go for their entire lives. They were never going to stop. They wanted to end apartheid. And she said, the second thing is that any one of them could have been Mandela. Yet they chose to play the role in the collective that would make the biggest difference to their purpose, their collective purpose. So you had people like Albertina and Walter Sisulu. You know, Walter was the planner. Albertina rallied the women's marches in South Africa. You have people that Paul partnered with very closely. Archbishop Tutu was obviously the rebel rouser. But you also had Leah, who was the rock in the communities. And you had people like Helen Sussman, who started the Progressive Party. And for 13 years, she sat in Parliament trying to get them to end apartheid. And so this moment made me realize that it was this entire collective that then mobilized the world to take down apartheid. And the role that Mandela played so beautifully in all of these large collaborations that we studied, there was always what we call this intoxicating purpose that people could not get behind. And what I just wanted to share with you is Mandela at his trial in the Rivonia trials gave a 3-hour speech. And this is his audio from the courtroom.
I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
When he gave that final speech from the dock. The thing I'm sure many of you do know, but it's worth underlying, is that he was about to be sentenced by a judge who the prosecutors had asked to sentence him to death. And Nelson Mandela exists today because that judge at that moment heard that speech and made a decision merely to sentence him to life imprisonment. But to say to a judge before you're about to be sentenced, it is an ideal for which I'm prepared to die, takes a kind of a courage that is worth just pausing and reflecting on. The second thing, all those people who you mentioned who were the kind of Mandela ecosystem, in October of 1989, I was one of about 100 people when they were released from prison, and the first public appearance they made was at a house in Soweto, and they'd never been seen for 20 years plus because they'd all been in Robben Island. And these heroes of the anti-apartheid movement all shuffled into this little house, and they were all 25 years older. So they were gray and they were slightly diminutive and they looked like shadows of their former self. And I remember as a young man looking at them and going, oh God, that's our movement. And these are the people who are going to lead us to revolution, and feeling very scared. And then they all opened their mouths and they said exactly what you said, which is, we're a movement, we love each other, we trust each other. There are millions of people who are behind us, in front of us, and Madiba is still in prison, and we're going to do this collectively. And everybody walked out of that room going, we're going to win, because they had exactly that sense of an unshakable purpose and an incredible connection and trust between them. So, you know, I think I can bear witness to what you've said. So I'm going to ask you around the first question I want to ask you around partnering is, you have people who are partners in business, and then you have people who are partners in love in this book. And they share some similarities, but they also have some differences. And you got to watch both of those. You saw Grusha and Mandela, I mean, and Leia and Desmond Tutu and Jimmy Carter and Rosalind, and you watch those partnerships. So can we start just by talking about those? Because anybody who's in a love relationship is interested in some of your insights from those, because those were also relationships which were profoundly purposeful as well as being from the heart. So tell us a little bit about that category first.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that when I started doing these interviews, I started doing them based on romantic love relationships. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to do 10 interviews. That's going to be it. I'm going to figure this out, write a book, blah, blah. And this was, 17 years ago. And what was really interesting is then I interviewed Ben and Jerry. And when I interviewed Ben and Jerry, they talked more about love than the partnerships that were in romantic relationships almost. It just blew my mind. And I realized that we almost put these divides between our relationships when it's, again, we found these 6 degrees to be common, whether they were romantic, whether they're business. That's what was at the heart of them. And if you look at people like Grasa and Madiba, I mean, you walk in, like, I'll never forget the very first moment in meeting them, is you just felt this incredible presence of love. And they were so present with one another. And they also never, ever did anything, like no body language, no word that would undermine the other one. Everything they did was lifting of the other one. And I saw that repeated in every single partnership I interviewed. And so again, I would bring back to Ben and Jerry were just as in love with each other as any romantic partnership I'd ever seen. They realized that having love at the center of their business and with each other was what was going to make them successful.
So I'm going to ask you a question for which I'm sure there's no standard answer, but you mentioned how partnerships are often about difference and complementary skills, and, you know, the Ben and Jerry, I'm the guy who, like, shouts at people and sees what's wrong, and I'm the person who mops up behind and helps people implement the kind of insights, and those two things actually work out in partnership, but we're actually very, very different. But also, relationships sometimes work because people are fundamentally the same. And so I'm sort of interested in the people that you interviewed. Let's start on the kind of romantic front. How often were they sort of just at the core the same despite what their surface differences were? Or how often were they actually quite radically different, but they found a chemistry and a compatibility and a partnership across that difference? So is there something, you know, if you were to take a bet on a long-term relationship or partnership, would you say do it with people who are fundamentally the same or perhaps deeply different?
I think what we found during this exploration is that they were fundamentally the same in their set of values, but they were radically different in many other aspects of their life. And you know, if you take some of the examples of the partnerships, that difference is what they often called kind of this electric current of difference that helped them become better people. And I'm sorry, I'm going to go against your romantic example here. Sorry, Paul. I'm going to give one that is just the most beautiful. Two examples of radical difference. One is Bertrand and André. They were two people. Some of you may know the chaps that did the solar impulse flight around the world. So they were very different. You had Bertrand, who was out there speaking all the time. He'd given 1,000 speeches, great speaker. And you had André, who was the operations guy. So he was the guy behind the scenes that was making sure that the plane flew. And so they came together, and when they first came together, because Bertrand was used to giving speeches, he was constantly out there. And then they had this moment of incredible friction because all the media was saying, oh, this is Bertrand's solar impulse. And so André was kind of like, oh, why am I not getting mentioned? So they came into a safe space together and talked this through and then realized why this was happening, because Bertrand was so much more comfortable out front. And André was so much more comfortable behind the scenes. But in that moment, what they agreed to do is that they were going to teach each other. André was going to teach Bertrand how to fly the plane, and Bertrand was going to teach André how to be a speaker. And they said the happiest moment of their life was the day that Bertrand flew Solar Impulse and that André got his first standing ovation. And so they talked a lot about how this difference, they actually became better people. They competed with themselves to become better people. And we saw that also in the romantic relationships that came together. Like if you look at Leah and Archbishop Tutu, radically different people, completely different people. You know, Archbishop Tutu wanting to be with people, that rabble-rouser all the time. Leah behind the scenes, much quieter. But the unbelievable depth and joy that you had, and those two supported one another, this united belief, like I'll never forget, and you probably know this story, Paul, but one time, like the whole interview with them was just like charged with energy and laughter and joy, and then they both went really silent. And then Archbishop talked about, you know, at one point in South Africa, I was getting yelled at all the time by everyone was saying, you know, Archbishop Tutu talks too much. He should shut up. So Archbishop Tutu went back to Leah and he said, should I shut up or what? Should I be being quiet? And Leah looked at him and she said, I would rather that you be imprisoned on Robben Island than free and quiet outside. And then Archbishop Tutu went on to say, that's what held him instead when he was out there fighting, because he knew that Leah 100% had his back and wanted him to go on this purpose and wanted to work with him on this journey. And so, in answer to your question, I think if I look at a couple, it's not about the differences that are going to determine whether the partnership survives. It's about how much they listen to each other, how much they're present with each other. You know, John Gottman, the amazing relationship leader in America, is just brilliant. He calls it, he said he can tell whether a partnership's going to work through bids of attention. So he said, every day we all give each other bids of attention. And for example, if you come home and you had a really bad day and you're like, oh my God, this happened, and your partner just turns and doesn't look and doesn't listen. Or if they sit and listen to you. So he was saying partnerships that have 80% of the time the other partner responds to that bit of attention, that relationship's going to work. If they only respond 30% of the time, likely not. Because it's about being present And listening, that deep listening, came up again and again.
You know, the Arch told a story, which I'm sure you heard as well, but he once told a story about partnerships and about Leia, and said, sometime after you've had a really brutal day, what you really want is for somebody to come up to you and give you your slippers. And it's such a sort of sweet idea that, and then as a great testament to their relationship, about an hour later, he like sort of went on record and said, there's something really sort of, that sounds really wrong and patriarchal about that statement, that, you know, you go out there and somebody gets you your slippers. And my metaphor for that is the ways in which I do things for Leia and Leia does things for me, that we provide each other with mutual support. And I tell that story partly because he had the wherewithal in describing their relationship to self-edit and be reflective of how that would be seen and perceived, and was aware enough about the bit of a tension between them that that was not something that it was just, well, I'm the famous person and you're bringing me my slippers, but actually real relationships work when you're bringing each other slippers, not just, it's not just unilateral. And I wonder, in relationships where one person is maybe more quote-unquote famous or public, but they have this rock still, this enduring relationship, what you've seen about what must be a real necessary tension in adulation and attention and being in the back room, and how those relationships work to kind of correct what might be power imbalances that emerge, or psychological imbalances if people are not thoughtful and generous.
Yeah, and I think the answer is in the word you just used, because I don't think there was power imbalances in these partnerships in these 65, because they deeply respected and trusted each other for who they were. Like Joe Confino loves to say, you know, love is respecting the partner for where they are in their life right now. And it was respecting that. It was the other thing that was really beautiful, is a sense of shared humility. And people, all of these partnerships had that deep sense of confidence that comes from understanding what their weaknesses are and knowing that they couldn't do it by themselves, and actually giving respect and gratitude to their partner who brought that to the relationship. So I think the partnerships didn't have a power imbalance. If they had a power imbalance, they would have broken. And that's one of the things, again, because one of the things we studied is, why do partnerships break? And one of the key ones was this imbalance of commitment and power. And these partnerships had figured out how to make sure there was a balance by deeply respecting, being grateful, being humble, and realizing that that other partner brought as much to the relationship, just different things.
You didn't do it in your talk, but it's in the book, and you probably can rattle them off, but if you can't rattle them off, I'm going to hand you the chapters in your book, because I read them, which is just going through these degrees in partnering, because I think it's actually wonderful for the people listening in, just to give you a little synopsis of it, because I found it, and then you give it a guide to each chapter. But would you do us the honor of doing that?
Yeah, sure. It's definitely in the books. You can see it as well. But the 6 degrees, the first one that came up, it was interesting because we chose these people because we knew that they had a bigger purpose in life. But what we didn't realize is that what we called something bigger in the end, it wasn't just present, it dominated. It was unbelievably how powerful it was. And it wasn't just about, it was two things actually. It was the partnership helping each other with their purpose, whether it was individual or shared. But it also was the thing that was the connective tissue in their relationship. Just as you explained about the anti-apartheid heroes coming together, they had that connective tissue of something bigger. So that was number one by far. And then there was this beautiful concept of being all in and not holding anything back. And, you know, Keith Yamashita had a beautiful line where he talked about trust before being trusted, love before being loved, and that ability to be all in. And the third one was this beautiful thing that emerged called, we called it the ecosystem of virtues. And we call them virtues on purpose, because if any of you are running companies or have been in companies, or you know often that those values get plastered on the wall and then no one really lives them. So we wanted to call them virtues because they're something that these people and these partnerships lived every day. And there were 6 of those that were consistent across all partnerships. And then the other three were interesting because the fourth one I never expected, which is something we call magnetic moments. And all of these partnerships had thoughtfully thought about rituals, daily practices, traditions to keep them connected. And just unbelievable. Every one of them had these ideas, different ideas. And then the fifth one, which I probably struggled with the most, was around what we call celebrate friction. And so it was really interesting how when we first started, when I first started interviewing these folks, everyone said to me, you have to find the drama, you have to find the plate throwing, the hair pulling. And I really tried in the early interviews to pull those strands out. But what I found was something more beautiful, that these partnerships had put in place these tools that allowed them to flow above the drama. I think we're so, like, I don't know what the, we're so brainwashed through media, through everything, to think there has to be drama. When these folks, there wasn't not friction, but what they'd done is they'd flowed above that friction. They turned what Andre and Bertrand call it, they turned the friction into sparkles, and into a learning experience. And they use these tools. There's 12 tools in the book on how these partners did that. And then the last degree, the sixth degree, we called collective connections, because that's how you take these individual deep connections, like they did with the ozone community, like they did with ending smallpox in India, like they did with our apartheid, and ladder them up into these large-scale collaborations. And I feel like that last one is so important for the world right now, because we do have to radically collaborate, and we need to learn how to use those deep connections at the center.
And you didn't even need the prompt from the book. That's impressive. So I wanted to ask, you keep mentioning, and it's implicit in many of these, this question of trust. And in some ways, trust is one of those things which, like, either have it or you don't. You start with it or you don't. You can break it and potentially not repair it. But it seems to be a sort of common thread in all of these, that ups and downs, hard days, bad days, complexity, failures, successes, you fundamentally trust that person. And so I wondered if you thought that that was just a necessary precondition and table stakes, or whether in those relationships you actually saw them nurturing, cultivating, building, deepening trust as a sort of practice, because I think that may be a useful thing for all of us to think about.
Yeah, and I think the trust was the number one thing that came out of the ecosystem of virtues. Like, every single partnership talked about it. And I think they had to be open to trust, but I don't think they had to be perfect at trust. So what they learned in their partnerships, and, you know, Derek and Beverly Jobert, who work with big cats in Africa, one thing they talked a lot about, because the question a lot comes up, can you make mistakes? Can you break trust? And can you still get back on track? And, you know, Derek said it so beautifully. He's like, of course. He said, we're all going to make mistakes and break trust by accident. And that becomes a log on your fire of trust, and you keep on building it. And, you know, Sarah Kay, the wonderful spoken poet, had a beautiful way to look at this, because she said she has rules with all her partnerships where if she does something to break trust or hurt them, that they must tell her that, because they have to know that she'd never had the intention to hurt them. And so she lives within that space. And that was a big thing that came out, is that always assuming that people are coming from a place of good intention. And that changes your relationship dramatically when you make that assumption. And then creating, the thing that they all did really beautifully is they created these safe spaces for trust to build and to grow, and literally physical spaces, but also coming together. And one that I love is Airbnb. The co-founders of Airbnb had this beautiful thing called, which I never ever would have thought these three words have gone together, but elephants, dead fish, and vomit. And what they would do is they would have every week in their team meeting, they would have a certain amount of time for elephants, dead fish, and vomit. So the elephants were things that people weren't talking about. The dead fish were things that have been living in the room for years and no one's addressing. And then the vomit was just sometimes people just need to get stuff off their chest. And so creating those safe spaces allowed them to build and deepen the trust. And all of them had these incredible rituals where they created that space for trust to grow. But trust, you know, it's never going to be perfect. We are all going to make mistakes. And that's the other thing I actually should have said right up front, is Every single one of these partnerships talked about how that it's hard work. It is not easy to build partnerships. But then on the other side of that, they said it was the most rewarding, fulfilling thing. It is what made their life meaningful, were these partnerships and the ones that they nurtured, even if they only had one or two or a handful.
So it strikes me that a lot of the prescriptions around trust to be able to do elephants, dead fish, and vomit in a company, but to do the equivalent in a relationship requires an ability and an aptitude to communicate, and to communicate well, and to communicate clearly, and to communicate your feelings and intentions, and to have the courage to say things that are hard or that make you vulnerable or that expose you or that show your flaws. And so I wonder, in these great partnerships, whether you actually detected things about how they spoke to each other and how they communicated and how they exchanged ideas, again, in ways that we may be able to take some reflections or lessons from, in part because I think maybe because of social media, maybe because we spend too much time looking on our phones, that I feel as though there may be in recent years an erosion of our ability to look each other in the eye, to say how we feel, to communicate in full sentences, to be open and vulnerable when we're all doing WhatsApp and texts, and terrible erosion of an ability to authentically communicate.
Yeah, and communications was one of the biggest things. And if you look at that category around magnetic moments, they all had rituals, traditions, and practices around communication. It was core to them. And one that I loved was Joe Confino and Paz, or a romantic relationship, but they had this beautiful thing called Friday Talk. So every single Friday, they would go away from their home in a safe space somewhere for an hour and a half. And what each person would have the chance to do is talk about, firstly, anything that was great in their partnership that week. So anything that just was fantastic and set their heart on fire. And then they had, each of them had to listen, just sit there and listen deeply while the other one spoke. So there was no interrupting. There was no, oh my God, you did that. But, and then after that, they then had another period of time where each one of them talked about things that upset them that week. And so they said it did a number of things. If they had like a fight that week, or if they had something that went wrong, they didn't have to react to it in the moment, because they knew that they had Friday Talk on Friday, which that they could go and talk about this rather than erupting. And they also said just keeping that Friday, every Friday, having that moment allowed them to build the muscle, really, to have those honest conversations with one another ongoing, so they didn't build up. And I think the other thing that, just like with Ben and Jerry, for example, like I've worked with them now for probably about 20 years, and I've never once seen them undermine the other one with a glance, with any type of negative body language, because those are the kinds of things that immediately break trust or make people defensive, so they're not going to be open up and have a conversation. I think that was common throughout all of them. And the other thing that was very interesting, one of the reasons why I think you don't see the drama in a lot of these partnerships, is because they have something that I ended up calling positive amnesia. Because I know some of them have had really difficult times in the past, and so I knew like where some of those hotspots were and trying to get them to talk about them. But what was really beautiful is they didn't want to hurt the other partner. And they had literally, after something had happened, they had talked about it and just let it go and really forgave in a deep level, forgave so deeply that they couldn't remember it, and let it go. And so I think that sense of positive amnesia is another thing that just allows and creates that space for honest communication.
You allude to it in a couple of places in the book, but you allude to it with a kind of, in a way that's subtle and a little bit elegant and a little understated. But I want to surface something, again, which I think can be relevant to partners or also in relationships to each other, and that is romance, intimacy, chemistry. And in some ways, romance, intimacy, and chemistry can stand in opposition to some of the calm, rational, safe space, thoughtful, because it's about passion and feelings, and, you know, it shortcuts some of the more contemplative parts of your brain. And I wonder whether there are any lessons, because you're oblique in parts of the book, but you're also a little more forward in other parts, about things about how you are both respectful and rational and do all these things that seem so sort of thoughtful and almost programmed and rational, but also have those sort of sparks that are necessary to people who are in intimate connection to each other, not just business partnerships.
And I think this definitely was unbelievable passion and sparks of romance, and, you know, with all these romantic relationships. And it was also there in the business and the friendship. You know, it wasn't the word as we know it, intimacy, that they would, but it was just this unbelievable deep connection that they had. So I don't think that those things go away. I think they deepen, because you have this unbelievable trust and respect for each other as a foundation that allows you to even love more passionately and more deeply, and forget about the things that drag most partnerships and relationships down. I think it heightened that sense. And I think the other really interesting thing is these partnerships had that passion for something bigger. You know, they, all of them had a passion for some, whether, again, it was individual purpose or whether it was combined. And Jacqueline Novogratz, who runs Acumen, and Chris Anderson, who runs TED, you know, Jacqueline was petrified to get married, petrified, because she thought she would lose her independence. And, you know, Chris put something in their vows that said, "I will never hold you back." And if you look at their partnership, because he's never held her back and because he's supported her purpose and she supported his purpose, they've actually become more connected from a romantic perspective, from a passion perspective. It's allowed them to flourish independently and then strengthen their partnership.
I think we are out of time. So I am going to do a huge round of applause for Jean and for her incredible book.
Thank you, Paul. And thanks again, Izzy Rose. Thank you guys so much. And thank you guys for being here. Yeah, and I'd love to hear of any, because the other thing we're doing is we're continuing to interview partnerships. So if people have ideas, please share them with us as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations Live. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. And to learn more about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.